Moncrief on News Talk.
When Willie Nelson was asked, should he not retire, he said, "My life pretty much consists of playing golf and singing songs for people. Which do you want me to give up?" Because that is a thing you never hear, a rock star who retires. Obviously, Willie Nelson isn't really a rock star. Decades ago, popular music was seen as a young person's game, yet as musicians aged, so did the upper ceiling for performing it. So why and how do they keep going? David Hepworth is the author of Hope I Get Old Before I Die, Why Rock Stars Never Retire. Afternoon, David.
Good afternoon.
Is it part of this, at least, a function that the way we perceive popular music has changed? Say, you know, 50 years ago, kids would listen to it and their parents would abhor it. And it was seen as, you know, there was very much a generation gap there. But that really doesn't exist anymore now.
It doesn't exist in the same way. I mean, it used to be a largely young people's pursuit, didn't it? Popular music was, I suppose, aimed at people under 35. Mm. Whereas nowadays, you know, if you went to a Taylor Swift show, there'd probably be people as young as 10, and there'd be people as old as, you know, 60, 70 or whatever. And, you know, you could make similar observations about all kinds of shows, you know. It's mainstream entertainment for absolutely everybody nowadays.
Yeah.
And there is a greater kind of reverence, oddly enough, for age in popular music. You know, that people tend to go through a period where they're kind of hot when they're young, and then they cool off a little bit in middle age, and people don't want to know them for a while. But then they kind of come back in their 50s, and I think one of the things that happens is their original fans have started to get, you know, they've gone through the babysitting years and whatever, and now they feel like going out again and kind of celebrating the music of their youth, which is what they tend to do in their 50s, 60s and 70s, which accounts for the fact that the Rolling Stones and Paul McCartney and Bob Dylan and Willie Nelson, which you previously mentioned, who I think is 91, isn't he? He's still on the road, I think, in the US this year. Absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, well, he's been stoned out of his gourd since the mid-60s, so he probably doesn't know what age he is.
He also lives on a bus, doesn't he, Willie Nelson? So, you know, so he's completely attuned to the kind of impermanence of a musician's life.
Yeah.
He's not a person who would like to be at home at all. You know, that's the interesting thing. And Ronnie Wood of the Rolling Stones said to me quite a few years ago now, he said, it's all very well being, you know, home, and it's nice to be with the family and so forth. But he says, at 9 o'clock every night, my body thinks it should be doing something. Hmm. You know, and when you're attuned to the kind of adrenaline rush of performing in front of, in his case, enormous crowds, that must be a very, very difficult thing to give up. You know, footballers give it up. They have to give it up.
Yeah.
Musicians don't. That's the odd thing. You know, that rockstar was the profession that was supposed to have least certain career, you know, certainty. You know, you couldn't depend on it. Well, it's ended up being the job that people can depend on more than anything else. You know, if you stayed at school, did your exams and got a job as a bank manager, you were probably made redundant at the age of 50.
Yeah.
Whereas Ronnie Wood, you know, not far off 80 or whatever, is still being Ronnie Wood. It's absolutely extraordinary.
Now, and decades ago, would have been thought to be a bit unseemly for somebody over the age of 35 to still be in the music business. You reckon that it was around the time of Live Aid where perhaps that attitude changed, or the industry changed its perceptions?
My book starts with Live Aid, really, and comes up to the present day, because the interesting thing to me about Live Aid was that, you know, the guy brought on at the end at Wembley was Paul McCartney, who was the venerable old chap, you know, was apparently coming down from Mount Rushmore to address us all. Well, he was 43 years old, you know, which we considered quite old at that stage. Well, we no longer consider that old at all, you know. And in fact, what was happening with Paul McCartney was, and like many of his generation, they were sort of only just getting started, you know, because also this is the beginning of open-air shows, you know, which was still relatively in their infancy around about the time of Live Aid. Bruce Springsteen, only played live outdoor for the first time in his career that year in Ireland at Slane.
Wow.
That was the first time he played outdoors. He thought, this is never going to work. You can't do this. Well, of course, he got over his concerns about it, and everybody else got over their concerns about it. And so, you know, suddenly people were very excited about the idea of going to these massive shows and being part of these 70,000-numbered, you know, throngs who were part of the show. And, you know, so the audience grew massively at that point and has continued to grow to this day, you know, so that nowadays going to a big kind of rock show is sort of thing that people just do. It's part of the social calendar, isn't it? Like going to the football or the golf or, yeah, I don't know, whatever other festivals of the seasons, you know. They think it's a really important thing to do. And also they are spending sums of money on it that nobody would dare predict 30, yes. 40 years ago.
Yeah, and I suppose the industry, or somebody in the industry, or people, spotted that tip from, we're going to make reducing amounts of money from recorded music, we're really going to start making the money from gigs.
Yeah, I don't think it was even as considered as that. It was just a kind of response to changing circumstances. And so the tour that kind of changed it all was the Rolling Stones tour, the Steel Wheels tour in 1989, where they realised that, okay, people will pay a lot more money and we'll make that money back through merchandising, through drink sales, through, you know, increased ticket prices, all that kind of thing. And you know, they took the bet that people would do it. And they were absolutely right, you know. So that's just continued climbing and climbing, you know, to this day. And you know, has resulted in the most recent controversy over Oasis tickets over the last week or so. You know, if it wasn't Oasis, it would be somebody else, whoever is the newest act to come along and charge slightly more than people charged the year before. But the interesting thing is there seems to be no disinclination on the part of the public to pay it. That's the strange thing.
But there has been lots of huffing and puffing in this country and in the UK about the whole dynamic pricing model, etc. Do you think that's just noise? It won't really result in anything.
I think it would be very difficult for governments to legislate about it. I think that's one thing we've discovered. You know, how they resolve it, I do not know. But, you know, somebody did some research, a university in the States did some research, I think 10 years ago, at a Bruce Springsteen show. They just identified a block of tickets, block of seats at a big arena show and said, okay, these are $50 tickets. Let's go and ask all those people what they paid. And, of course, what they found was that people paid far more or less or the same or whatever. And so if far more money is coming in for those seats, the performer's manager, wants that money. They don't want it going to touts. They don't want it going to members of the public who've bought four tickets and are going to sell two in order to pay for the other two. Do you see what I mean? Because you know, online trading has turned us all into touts, it seems. You know, it's so much of the background of this book. Yeah, the massive changes in technology, you know, as exemplified in social media and phones and so forth, that have utterly changed, utterly reshaped the way these things are done. One of the most startling things, reflections to me about doing the story was, you know, it starts with Live Aid. And Live Aid was a kind of miracle of logistics, accomplished without the use of a single mobile phone. Which is just absolutely extraordinary if you think about it now. You know, people can't do anything without a mobile phone. So a mobile phone has kind of accelerated all those transactions. You know, and so you now, if you're looking for reasons why people go to huge great shows or Glastonbury or so forth, Instagram is a massively important component in that. You know, it's going to something and showing people that you're at something. You know, is hugely important. So technology has been strangely instrumental in keeping these big old names, you know, still at the top. Because the strange thing is, I think it's in the book, you know, Ringo Starr, you know, when he was interviewed in 1964 or whatever, what do you think you'll do when you're older? He said, well, I think I might have enough money to run a chain of hairdressers, you know, because his girlfriend was a hairdresser. It was just modest, just a chain, you know, nothing mad, just a chain, two or three, you know, because that's how people looked at the world in those days. You know, that's what football managers did, or footballers, or whatever. Yeah. They retired, they took on a pub, or they started a sports shop. That's what you did. He didn't predict that in his 80s he would be Sir Ringo Starr and would be arguably more famous now than he was then.
Yeah.
Because, do you know what I mean? Because everybody's children, grandchildren, whatever, knows who Ringo Starr is. Do you know what I mean? And so it's kept, this same technology has kept these people from disappearing in a way that I'm not sure the old world of traditional media would have done. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, no, I do. But it's also curious in you know, that sense of kind of attending an event has slightly changed our kind of our values in terms of buying music or how we consume it in the sense of, if you went to someone who spent 400 quid on two Oasis tickets last week and you asked them, would you spend 400 quid on recorded music, they'd think you were insane.
Well, also, the interesting thing is, if somebody's paid 400 quid to go and see a live show, or £100, or 50, anything more than 10, yes, and you ask them how was it, they're always going to say the same thing. It was amazing.
Mm.
Because why would you not? You know, you can't say, I paid 500 quid and was slightly disappointed because the sight lines weren't very good and they didn't play my favourite. They're just not going to do that. You know what I mean? It's like spending a lot of money on a wedding. You're going to say it's great, aren't you? It's everything you ever wanted. You know, so our values in terms of all these things have changed, you know. So that's the kind of, that's the background of the book, you know. So the book has kind of two strands to it, really. One is the lives of the performers who maintain their incredible prestige and celebrity into their 70s and 80s. And also us, the audience. What does our continuing attachment to these people say about us and how much it means to us? And I do find this absolutely fascinating, you know, that, you know, when groups reform, I don't think it's anything to do with music. I think it's to do with spectacle. Mm. It's to do with ceremony. It's to do with, you know, ritual. It's to do with seeing your 14-year-old heroes back on stage in their 60s with their arms around each other. And you sort of feel that something in your life has been repaired simply by looking at them. Do you see what I mean? It's beyond music. Because also we've had a lifelong relationship with these people. These people became our fantasy friends when we were 14, 15. And at every stage in our lives, we've looked at them. Everybody's got a rock star who is roughly the same age as they are, everybody. And everybody looks at them and thinks, well, he or she, they're doing all right. Oh, no, they're looking a bit shabby or whatever. You know, and they kind of measure themselves against your kind of fantasy friend. You know, it's a unique relationship.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen with anything else. It doesn't happen with football. You know, your attachment is the team, the club. It's not individual players that follow you. You don't follow them through life. You know, you don't do it with movie stars. You don't do it with people off the telly. You do it with rock stars. It's a unique relationship.